The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt live inside the Beltway on this Thursday morning. Let me begin with the rundown. Citizens in Ukraine are being urged to flee the eastern region as the Russians appear to prepare a massive reinforcement of their eastern landing in an attempt to secure their Donbass to north of Odessa stretch of the country. And they have totally withdrawn from Kyiv. I was watching Brett Baer on Special Report last night, and the map shows that they've just left. They've been defeated in the north. Doesn't mean that they've been defeated, but they've been defeated in the north. President Biden is going to ban new investment in Russia through an executive order. Good for him. The White House has sanctioned Putin's children. Another good move. The Red Cross cannot get into Mariupol because the Russian war criminals are not allowing them to enter. And that is, by the way, you ought to know, a war crime to obstruct the Red Cross in the doing of its internationally agreed upon duties. Lithuanian Olympic champ in the display of support for Ukraine swam through. This is kind of disgusting, but it's also kind of interesting. Return to the water. We have to be realistic. They turned a pool completely blood red. And it's a really remarkable thing if you can find it on the internet. The Finnish government has seized Russian artwork worth $46 million under sanction. So somebody is unhappy in Russia, another person. And our job is to make every Russian unhappy with Putin. Germany intercepts Russian conversations on killing civilians in Bucha. Germany's Foreign Intelligence Service claims to have intercepted radio communication in which Russian soldiers discuss carrying out indiscriminate killings of civilians in Bucha. Everything is listened to. Everything is collected. Not everything is listened to. And therefore, you have to go back through every one of the intercepts of the intelligence that you have, and then you find what you need. A 10 high-rise building, 10, not a 10 high, story, but 10 different high-rise buildings in Svetlodonetsk were fired upon overnight. We will kill you. How Russia silenced an anti-war movement. And it's the story of one Russian dissident who basically took his 10 days in jail and left for Georgia, the country, the day after he was released from custody. Because they said to him, we will kill you if you keep this up. The U.S. imposed severe sanctions, according to the Financial Times, on Russian banks that weren't in place. Senator Cotton asked yesterday, I saw this on Special Report last night. I'll be on the panel on Special Report tonight. I encourage you to join in. He was saying, why do we still have sanctions left to impose? I'm glad we're doing it. But why do we have sanctions left to impose? Why haven't we done everything that we should be doing? If you're watching on the Salem News Channel and you see me wiping my nose, it's because the allergy season has arrived suddenly in Virginia. It went from winter to the pollen is thick in the air. John Lee, the number two official in Hong Kong, has resigned as the chief cop there. He is a hardliner. He is poised to take over for Carrie Lam, who's a bozo, and he's going to bring totalitarian fury and fear to an already repressed people. That's unfortunate. In Israel, we'll talk with Michael Oren later this hour, former Israeli ambassador to the United States, former deputy minister. The coalition is falling apart. The coalition that unseated Netanyahu, and they have now lost their majority. The Yamina faction had one of their cabinet members walk across the aisle, did what Churchill did when he was a young conservative and crossed the aisle to become a liberal, and he later crossed the aisle again to become a conservative again. As you said, anyone can rat. It takes something to re-rat. And so she left, and now Hebrew media indicates that they are scrambling to hold it together. They've lost their majority, but it doesn't mean Netanyahu has a majority. The balance of power now rests with the Arab List, the joint Arab List. Netanyahu is calling on other members of the right-wing part of the left-center right-wing coalition government that united to throw him out to come home to Likud. We'll follow that closely. Boris Johnson is in big trouble. Not really. He's doing a fine job leading the United Kingdom. He survived Partygate. He has said that biological males should not compete in women's sports. Now, in the United States, that would have got him banned from Twitter before Elon Musk arrived. And I have a new column coming up on Elon Musk and what it means for Twitter over at thewashingtonpost.com. I'll tell you when it posts. It'll be on the landing page sometime this morning. Boris Johnson has said he does not think, quote, biological males should be competing in women's sports. The prime minister said the sensible view was that transgender athletes, such as Leah Thomas, a swimmer who won America's top trophy in university sports last month, should not be allowed to compete alongside biological women, and that children should not be allowed to decide their own gender without parental assistance. His most comprehensive comments yet on transgendered issues come today's after the government decided not to ban trans conversion therapy, as the Conservative Party promised in the last election. Mr. Johnson also said he thought it was important to have women-only spaces in hospitals, prisons, and changing rooms, but admitted there were complexities and sensitivities around transgender issues that will still need to be worked out. Well, he's right. There are sensitivities that need to be worked out, and biological men should not compete against biological women in sports, no matter how many hormones they've had, because they had the benefit of testosterone for as many years as they did not suppress those hormones. And I am not very certain about the wisdom of using hormone therapy on adolescents. Now, some of you believe in it, like 5% of people believe in it. And that's fine. I hope you are not in a position to impose that belief on a child. A child makes decisions that last for their life. Sterilizing themselves is not a good decision to make before you're 18. And certainly, I would think, not before you're 21 or 24. You want to support every child in all of their life. You want to give them unconditional love, but not unconditional permission. The Fed is preparing to slash the size of its swollen balance sheet by $95 billion a month. They're going to start shedding $95 billion a month of assets from its $9 trillion balance sheet. So 1% a month. That's what they're doing. They're going down about 1% a month. Nice and easy. They're looking for that soft landing that Westbury and I talked about yesterday. The Wall Street Journal reports that the Fed has also signaled that half percentage point rate increases could be warranted at coming meetings. I think I told you that yesterday from the Financial Times as well. Elon Musk, a new kind of media baron, charges into Twitter. They gave him a board seat, and immediately they announced from the Wall Street Journal, Twitter is working on an edit button. Early reviews are mixed. They've long needed an edit button. They've long refused to do it. Elon Musk has long wanted it. He buys 9% of the company, and now he gets an edit button. Pretty expensive edit button, but way to go, Elon. Google bans apps with hidden data harvesting software. Well, I'm glad to hear that. Facebook owner Meta is going to go back to the virtual currency market. One of the two times I sat down with Mark Zuckerberg, he was exploring virtual currency a long time ago. And he told Rostow that night he did not intend to replace the dollar as a reserve currency. But now Zucks Bucks is coming. Meta Financial has been exploring the creation of a virtual currency for the metaverse, Zucks Bucks. You know, I tell you what I tell you, and I've told you for 21 years. Buy what you know, invest in what you understand, buy what you use on the stock market. And if you want to go speculate in Zucks Bucks, don't complain to me when you get wiped out. When we come back, Joe Biden wants to keep student loan payments at bay, thereby rewarding everyone who borrowed money and doesn't have to pay it, and punishing everyone who did pay it off. That would be me. So I am just telling you right now, I don't think this is going to fly except with the hard left. I really don't think America approves of this. We'll talk about that and more stories. Dinosaur story this morning, early alert, here on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Good morning, Dr. Oren. How are you?
I'm good, Hugh. How are you?
I'm good. I want to do two things with you. I need an update on the tottering coalition, and then I want to talk to you about this essay. So after the break, we'll do the essay. Would you tell me about what the political situation is in Israel today?
You sure you want to hear this?
Yeah, because it doesn't make any sense to me.
They give you a headache on the morning, I'm telling you. And by the way, get a pencil out because there's going to be a quiz afterwards.
Okay.
According to you, there are 120 members of Knesset. Okay. In order to have a government, you have to have a majority. The smallest majority you can have is 61, where there's 59 people in the opposition. Okay. This present government had, as before yesterday, had 61 majority and one member of Knesset. And as it happened, the person who was actually the secretary of the coalition bolted. So now there is a 60-60 split, and you can't pass legislation with that. Matter, you can't do anything. You can even, I'll tell you the truth, I hope I'm not being too graphic, you can't even go to the bathroom because you have filibusters that go all night long. So it's not a sustainable position, and it means that that this government probably cannot survive much longer, and which means, as I've often said on this program, that it's always premature to eulogize Benjamin Netanyahu because he's back.
When he comes back, can he actually just overthrow? Can he get 61 himself, or do they have to go to the elections?
So that's the big question. So the question is whether he can now wean another person away from the coalition, and then he could put together a coalition of maybe 61. It's not pleasant, but okay, at least you become the prime minister, and then you don't have to go to elections. Or you can bring about a no-confidence vote that the government will lose, and the government will fall and will go to elections. Or you can wait till next March when the government has to pass another budget. It can't pass the budget. If you don't pass the budget, the government falls. So those are the three routes that Netanyahu has to returning to the premiership. He had a huge rally last night. It was a rally that originally was called to call for the government to fight against terror. Now it's a victory speech, and he's rallying the forces. So everything is in play right now, tremendous amount of confusion, and frankly, it's the time when we can least afford it. We are facing a wave of terror. I've been to a number of funerals and shivas, memorial gatherings in the last week. We are facing a probable renewal of the Iran nuclear deal, a very complex and combustible situation internationally surrounding Ukraine. It's the last thing we need right now. Is political confusion here.
Did the member who bolted the coalition bolt because of the handling of Ukraine by Bennett?
No. She bolted because she realized that Naftali Bennett no longer had a party. His party was originally a right-wing party. He's now in a government that includes leftists and includes Arab Islamists. And she realized that if she stayed with this party, she wouldn't have a political future. I think there's a moral aspect to it, too. She felt that the government had gone too far left wing also on religious issues. A big question about the degree to which the state of Israel can enforce observance of Passover regulations and restrictions, where you can bring bread into a hospital, for example. You get that, Hugh. They don't have bread in that. In the week, those issues. But I think she's really looking to her political future. And the scuttlebutt is that she's been promised a high-ranking position in a Likud government.
Now, my last question before I turn to your essay in the foreword, and we can do that after the break, is I think you need 61. I looked at the coalition numbers last night. I don't know how Netanyahu gets to 61. Do you?
Yeah, I think he could. If he gets this is going to get, again, you got to get that notebook open because there's going to be a test. If you get three members of a party to bolt a party, it has to be three, can't be any less, then they can create their own party. If it's one or two, they can't. So if Silman joins with two other members of Naftali Bennett's party, and there are two members now who are wavering, they can create their own party together with the ultra-Orthodox, together with other right-wing parties, and together possibly with Benny Gantz's party. Benny Gantz's party is blue and white. He's the former chief of staff. He was my military attaché in Washington. I know him quite well. They have nine members. And Benny Gantz does not like Bibi. Bibi, betrayed him in a previous rotation agreement. But Benny Gantz also doesn't like Yair Lapid, the foreign minister. He doesn't like the prime minister, Gantz. And Benny Gantz is in play. So I think that if Bibi offers Benny Gantz a rotation where Benny Gantz will be the first prime minister in the rotation and Bibi will be the second one, he can get nine seats, and if now he can put together a very stable government.
Well, that would be interesting because then, of course, down the road, Secretary of Defense Gantz would have the opportunity to put the knife into Netanyahu like Netanyahu did to him, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I'd worry about.
Rivals. you know, the book Team of Rivals, you know,
yes.
You know, Lincoln supposedly had rivals at his cabinet. They don't know nothing about rivals. every minister is a potential prime minister and is working to kill the prime minister at any given time.
That's what I love. Stand by, Michael. We'll come back after the break and talk about In Three Funerals, the real spirit of Israel is exemplified. Michael Oren returns. Don't go anywhere. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Dr. Michael Oren, former ambassador of Israel to the United States, joins me from Israel this morning. Three names, and this may shock you. I can't pronounce Hebrew very well. Sherelle Aboukrat, Yazan Fala, and Amir Khoury. All killed in the line of duty in the last few weeks in Israel. Michael Oren has attended all of their shivas. Michael, explain to people the organization of which you are part that visits the homes of the grieving.
I'm the chairman of the Hadass Malka Memorial Foundation. Hadass Malka was a 23-year-old sergeant in Israel's border police back in 2017, and she was murdered by a Palestinian terrorist outside the Damascus Gate. In Jerusalem, I attended her shiva as a member of the government. I attended every shiva, every memorial gathering for any Israeli soldier from any religious or ethnic background who was fallen in the line of duty. And I was deeply impressed by her story. She was a woman who was sent by the Air Force to have a desk job. She insisted on being a combat soldier. And her family was just an extraordinary family. And I said to them, if someday you want to memorialize your daughter, let me know, because I'll be there. And about 5 months ago, they established this foundation to give support to families from the border police and the police generally who are disadvantaged, who need support, who need encouragement to when they get out of the army. They very often come from very poor backgrounds. So it's a wonderful, wonderful organization. But as part of that, I continue to go to these memorial gatherings, to the shiva. And we had a terrorist attacks, three of them in the last week and a half. 11 Israelis were killed, among them three police, two from the border police, one from the regular police. But what was interesting and tragic about this was the policewoman from the border police, Sherelle, was Jewish, from a French Jewish family, very traditional. The Druze young man, Falah, was, you know, comes from Jerusalem, a tiny village up north near the Lebanese border. And then Amir Khoury, a policeman who's Christian from Nazareth, the son of a police officer. And if you go to three shivas in 3 days, one for a Jew, one for a Druze, and one for a Christian in Israel, you have a completely, completely different image of the image of Israel than the one you get in the Western press. Which is
all of them died serving their country.
All of them died serving their country proudly. And that's an important thing. And their families were proud that they were serving their family, and their families all served. That these people were unique. And the father of Amir Khoury, Jiris Khoury, is a decorated police officer. And the most amazing thing, you go to the shiva, and it's all these ultra-Orthodox Jews who came on buses because he was killed in an ultra-Orthodox city of B'nai Barak, to express their appreciation. You get all these people, you know, in ultra-Orthodox garb sitting at a Christian funeral, which you just, you know, people, that wouldn't
only in Israel.
Israel will have.
Yeah. Only in Israel. I've got to tell you, we are helping right now, the Alliance for International Alliance of Christian and Jews, bring Ukrainian Jews to Israel because they're trying to get the hell out of the way, the Russians. Will they be welcomed? Are they always welcomed?
Yes. Yes, yes. You know, the idea, we absorbed a million refugees from the former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, after the fall of the wall in 1989. That'd be equivalent to the United States absorbing the population of France, by the way, in less than a decade. And they have transformed Israel. And Israelis are aware of the fact that that immigration for us is a win-win-win situation.
But aren't you kind of amazed that there are that many Jews left in Ukraine and they're again being targeted?
Yes, and by the way, there are 200,000 Jews in Ukraine and 800,000 in Russia, which is a lot.
I don't think they're not being targeted in Russia, I hope. I know they are being targeted and the synagogues are being targeted as the Russians advance. The barbarity of the Russia. You dealt with the Russians both at the UN and in Washington, D.C. Are you surprised their troops are this undisciplined, Michael Oren?
I'm not surprised. And I'm not surprised even the cruelty and the barbarity that the Russian government shows to its own soldiers. There's a famous story, you know, I'm a historian, so I can't resist this. At Yalta, Eisenhower came up to Stalin and said, you know, how did you deal with the minefields? We had such trouble getting through those minefields in Germany. And Stalin laughed at him. He said, what are you talking about? We lined up our soldiers and we walked across them.
Yeah.
That's the Russians. That's the Russian army.
Your name came up on Tuesday night. I was at dinner with Walter Russell Mead. We were talking about power and fantasy in the Middle East, and historians know historians, and it came up. I am curious. Are you working on another book about modern Israel?
I'm about to start what I hope to be the definitive book on Israel's War of Independence, to do for that war what I did for the 1967 war. So that's a very long and difficult project. Straight up, I can't. I'm fundraising for it. Yeah, today I got a fundraise to do a book because books are very expensive. You have to pay for researchers and research around the world. So I'm literally fundraising for this book.
Are you doing GoFundMe?
Yeah, sure. I went to do a GoFundMe. I'm working through a wonderful organization called the Hidden Light Institute, which recently produced a great film about Menachem Begin. So they're taking this on as their next project. And that'll be about 4 years of very intense work.
Please, please, please let us know where we can tell the audience to go and support your work. We appreciate your joining us every week. Ambassador Michael Oren from Israel, thank you. Great piece in the Forward. I have Twittered it out. I would recommend to all of you follow Dr. Oren at Dr. Dr. Michael Oren on Twitter as well. The new Twitter, the Elon Musk Twitter. They'll never, ever ban him from that. Don't go anywhere. Hour number two straight ahead of the Hugh Hewitt Show on this third day. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt live inside a very wet beltway. Opening day in Kansas City today, where the Guardians take the field for the first time in their uniforms. They will be triumphant. They signed Jose Ramirez to a five-year extension yesterday, so we're feeling pretty good. I don't know if the Admiral is himself a baseball fan. Admiral Stavridis, are you a baseball fan?
No, not especially. I'm a tennis player, so I'm about as far from a baseball fan. I guess you hit balls in both sports. That's about the closest I can come to it.
Then you can adopt the Guardians. I'll just give them to you. But now, Admiral, let's go to the news. I had dinner on Tuesday night with our friend Jerry Hendricks and Mark Vandrop and 10 other navalists, and I'm the dummy in the room asking questions, obviously. And they were talking about the lessons being learned in Ukraine. I just want to give that open to you. What are the lessons we are learning in Ukraine?
Well, we're relearning a classic lesson of war, which is that when you go on offense, the defense has an inherent advantage. Clausewitz said defense is to offense as 3 is to 1. And the Russians came in with 180,000 troops against 150,000, 175,000 Ukrainians, and they've had a really tough slog. Number two, we have relearned that amateurs talk about strategy. The professionals are working on the logistics. This thing has become a logistic war, which the West is winning with good logistics, putting javelins and stingers and weapons in the hands of Ukrainians, and the Russians are failing badly. And the third lesson we relearn is that conscripts, reservists, lack of leadership hobble your forces greatly. So I think that package. And then secondly, I bet knowing Jerry Hendricks, who's one smart guy, you were probably talking about, does this whole thing tell us that tanks and low-flying aircraft are no longer useful on a battlefield because they were so chewed up by the Ukrainians? Here I'm a little more cautious, Hugh. I think it's a little premature to declare the end of armor on the battlefield. Although certainly, I'll close with this, the 21st century way of war is going to hinge more on unmanned, more on special forces who are armed with very lethal handheld weapons. And number three, and this is the surprising one to me, cyber. We really haven't seen the Russians use cyber yet. We need to pull into that and understand why that is. So there's a package. Apologize for the link, but there's
no. We may have deterred them. Is it possible that we deterred them on the cyber, it's given possible. What we said we would do?
Yes, it's possible that we deterred them. It's possible our side has literally blunted some of these attacks. That's possible. It's also possible, and I kind of go with this theory, that Putin is holding significant offensive cyber back as a war reserve to use, not principally against the Ukrainians, unfortunately, for us, but principally against us. Once sanctions start to really bite on his population, he's going to want to show some pain to the Western populations, and he can do it with cyber. So that's another possible explanation. But all of that requires some study. We need to understand why cyber has not been part of this battlefield.
No, Admiral, we had a couple admirals in the room, and so I just didn't say much. But you wear many hats. You're the retired Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, retired head of Southern Command. You were the chairman of the Rockefeller Foundation. You're one of the key guys over at Carlyle Group. Put all your hats on, because this was the big question. A senior member of the Senate, one of the big guys, said, look, I've got this mess of a budget here. What is the purpose of the American military, and what do you need first? And that, you know, it's just a back to basics question. And the abba dabba 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 that followed was pretty interesting to me, because people aren't used to what one of my colleagues at the dinner said. We've done the white paper look before. You know this, Admiral. There were three admirals in the room. And so the question is, what is the purpose of the American military, and what do we need most?
The purpose of the American military is defined under the law, and it's a pretty good definition, which is to be prepared to conduct prompt and sustained combat operations. And then for each of the departments, it says at sea, in the air, on the land, and in cyber, if you will, is kind of implied. So that sounds trite, perhaps, but I think it's a deceptively correct answer, which is be prepared. So that tells our budgeteers you have to focus on maintenance. You have to focus on procurement. You have to ensure that this force you have is prepared to go into combat to fight tonight. That has been something we've seen the Russians, for example, fail at. Be prepared to conduct prompt. So that tells me we need to be forward. Our forces need to be forward, because you can't be prompt if you're not forward deployed, forward stationed, working with allies. So conduct prompt and then end sustained. That gets into the logistics piece we just talked about. So a powerful logistics chain that can get everything forward. So bottom line, what does a Navy do, for example, because we don't have time to go through the less relevant services, shall we say, that's a joke. But the what the Navy does is forward presence, which is sea control. It is ensuring that we conduct strategic deterrence. That's our nuclear submarine force. It's strategic sea lift. And most recently, the queen of the seas in terms of mission has been power projection. So that is a snapshot of what militaries do, what navies do. And then the last thing is the geographic piece of it. And, you know, here I go with Bob Gates, who said, look, we're really good at predicting where the next conflict is. We have a perfect record, perfect in that we've never gotten it right. And his point is, you got to be ready to go where the fight might be, not where you think it's going to be. That's why navies, I think, are, in fact, so important and so valuable, because last time I checked, you can get to any coast in the world just about from the sea.
Now, the guest I had on Tuesday before the dinner is your old friend Bob Work, and we talked about the third offset. Seems to me that Secretary Work, who former Deputy Secretary of Defense, former Undersecretary of the Navy, is enamored of our missileing capability and is pointing at Ukraine as being the third offset, the first being atomic weapons, the second being precision munitions, the third being now long-range missiles. What do you make of that? Because that doesn't mean forward presence. If you can shoot a missile from California and hit a target in Ukraine, you don't need to have a ship in the Black Sea.
Right. And Bob and I have had this conversation 1.2 million times going back to when I was a Navy captain and he was a Marine Corps colonel, and we were the two executive assistants to Secretary of the Navy Richard Danzig. And we just have a fundamental disagreement here. I believe strongly in forward presence, as I hope I just articulated. Bob believes that given technology, you can do a lot more from home waters, if you will. You can do a lot with long range fires. I think we're both right. And the correct answer, in my view, is you try and find the balance between those two things. But if missiling, as you call it, or perhaps Bob calls it, means, and therefore we don't need a blue water forward Navy, then I think you're mistaken. And that takes us back to the beginning of the Republic, when Thomas Jefferson argued for effectively a gunboat Navy, gunboats in our own waters. That's not going to work, I don't think, in this modern world. You need to get forward.
Now, Senator Talent's coming up after you, and he just wrote about the need for more submarines. What I'm really curious about, and what they all said, I mean, of the 13 people, Secretary Work and the 12 people at this dinner, everyone agreed the budget is a mess. And one other member of Congress suggested we need a BRAC for legacy platforms. And boy, the one that get kicked around the most is the A-10. Apparently nobody likes the A-10 except Arizona senators. And a BRAC for legacy platforms, like we had a BRAC for legacy bases, makes a lot of sense to me. Does it make a lot of sense to you?
100%. And just to make sure listeners know what a BRAC is, a BRAC is a Base Realignment and Closure Commission. And what it means is that an independent group studies a package of assets and then moves a package of things to close forward. And here's the key. The Congress has to vote it up or down as a package. And that's how we got rid of a lot of frankly, useless real estate that was cluttering the Department of Defense balance sheet. And I think it is time to put that sort of principle together to look at some of these legacy systems that are sustained by local interests but aren't in the broad national interest. As much as I love the A-10, it's a very good aircraft in certain situations. Its time has come to come off our payroll. And I think there are other legacy systems out there in that regard. So, yes, I think BRAC would be a good idea.
Some smart person at the dinner, and it wasn't me, said, just give all the A-10s to South Korea. They're the only person in the world that might need them. I mean, you could have given them the Ukraine before this, and that would have been useful. But the South Koreans are the ones who are facing the prospect of hundreds of thousands of people coming over the border when you need a ground support aircraft like the A-10. And now I've exhausted my knowledge on the A-10. But how many other legacy systems are out there?
It depends on your viewpoint. You could certainly look at each of the services and think about everything from huge main battle tanks to aircraft carriers. I mean, personally, I wouldn't put them in that category, but I think some would think about it. Jerry Hendricks has done some pretty smart writing on we don't need these single, huge, massive nuclear-powered ones, but maybe take some of that money and put it into lighter, faster, somewhat smaller carriers that carry only unmanned systems, for example. Over on the Air Force side, some of the A-10, I think, is a pretty good example, some of the older systems like that. But again, we've had this conversation, but I think the new triad of war, the strategic triad of war, is going to be special forces, particularly armed with the kind of next generation weapons you're seeing in Ukraine. The second part of the triad, I think, is unmanned vehicles that run from deep submergence in the sea to high altitude drones to space systems. So unmanned. And the third piece, again, I'm perplexed that we haven't seen it on the battlefield, is cyber. I think we need to take funding out of the legacy systems and get it into those kinds of systems. And I think that's something Bob Work and I would probably agree on. And the second point I know he and I would agree on is the one continuity point are people, the all-volunteer force, doing everything we can to bring the very best people in and retain them. That's, frankly, the most expensive and the most critical thing in our budget there. That's the last system you're going to want to change. And I think Ukrainians are showing us that every single day.
Last quick question. The idea that came up is that Admiral Gilday has had four or five secretaries of the Navy in his time as CNO. And it was proposed that, like the FBI director, the service secretaries get 10-year terms. What do you make of that? I'm kind of attracted to that.
I am attracted to that. I've not heard it before. It does apply in a couple of other elements in the executive branch, certainly applies in the judicial branch. I'm not for life appointments, but I think a 10-year appointment would make some sense, particularly given service secretaries are at the heart of train, equip, and organize. Back to where we started this conversation, what are the purposes of the services? It would make sense to me.
Admiral, always a pleasure. Follow him on Twitter at StavridisJ. Thank you, Admiral. Jim Talon is next, America. Stay tuned. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. I'm tempted to talk to Senator Jim Talon, former senator from Missouri, about the Cephalosaurus that was killed 66 million years ago. It's breaking news in the British tabs today, but I won't. I'm going to talk to him about the Navy instead. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning. It's up to you. It's your show.
No, I want to talk to you about your submarine piece, because I went to this navalist dinner. I just talked to staff. I had Secretary Work on, and you wrote about what we need a submarine. You know what? One thing came out of agreement from this dinner is that we need a lot more submarine. We need the Columbia class. That's number one, but it's really not part of the Navy. It's part of the triad. And even though the Navy runs it, it should eat up all the Navy's budget. But boy, do we need a lot more Virginia class submarines. So you are a prophet in your own time, Senator.
Yeah. And one of the reasons, you, is that we are still ahead in the undersea domain vis-a-vis the Chinese. And these attack submarines are arguably the deadliest single platform in anybody's military anywhere. I mean, if we had double the number of votes that we have now, I think that might by itself put paid to the idea of a Chinese invasion of Taiwan. So, yeah, if there was one single need, I would focus on that. But, I mean, the needs are across the services and across the board. I mean,
now one of the submarine admirals in the room referred to himself as a bubblehead. I don't know where that term comes from, but I assume it got something to do with a bubble in a submarine.
I don't know. I mean, that's a good question. We should ask Jerry Hendricks. He would.
Okay. I think it refers to submarines. I just don't know.
I've never heard of bubble.
Neither I. But, you know, again, if you're the dumbest person in the room, you don't speak up a lot because you're the dumbest person in the room.
Listen, as you know, the submarine service is almost like a separate Navy. I mean, it's and that's one of the reasons it's so good, by the way. There's a whole story behind that with Hyman Rickover. You probably read a book on it.
Yes, and it's an amazing story. Let me go, though, to the proposal put forward by a legislator who was there. That poor Admiral Gilday, not poor, he's a very good CNO, has had four secretaries of the Navy in his 3 years, either confirmed or acting. And the proposal was, like the FBI director, we ought to have a 10-year fixed term for a service secretary. What do you think of that?
You know, I hadn't heard of that one before. I think we can get the kind of consistency we need without that long a fixed term. But I suppose if the person, which they would have to be, was removable, you know, if the president or the secretary of defense thought that he wasn't working out, that'd probably be okay. I mean, look, John Layman told me years ago that, because I asked him, how'd you build the Navy? And he said, you have to have a tight line of accountability and it has to run through the service secretary and the service chief, the CNO. In other words, you tell them, I want a plan. I want the plan within X number of months so you don't take 2 years to do the plan. Then you are going to build the plan. I'm going to help you in every way I can. But if you can't do it, I'll get somebody who'll do it. And that's how he built the Navy.
Well, and he wanted the job. It's the only job he wanted, and he stayed in the job.
Right.
And that's the problem, is that if you switch the top again and again and again, I mean, the SecDef might not change that, but he's got a lot of jobs besides. And the Deputy Secretary of Defense has got a lot of jobs. You need someone to be in that job long enough to execute a plan.
Yes. The statutory authorities run through, by and large, the service chiefs and the service secretaries. They're the ones in charge of the build and sustain role. So you need consistency. So if you got to change in administration, you really have to be careful about changing policy. You don't want to do it all the time. You want to plan and you want to execute. And you look, I know we can tie ourselves into knots trying to decide exactly what it is we should buy or build. And we're never going to get that exactly right. So you need sufficient top lines, first of all, to keep up with inflation. What we need is a 3-5% increase above inflation. Over the life of a fit-up, a five-year defense plan, then you need plans both to recapitalize the existing force structure and build the force of the future. We have to dig our way out of the readiness hole, invest in the industrial base, and we're going to need some end strength increases. I mean, you've been asking people all week what it is we need to buy. Yeah, at a certain level of detail, nobody knows, but anybody familiar with the services can basically give you a list of the basic needs.
Well, the other thing that came up is that the transitive principle ought not to apply between the Russian and the Chinese military. Just because the Russian ground forces suck, their missiles are pretty good, doesn't mean that the Chinese ground forces and military is going to suck. But unfortunately, there is a fear that many people will conclude that authoritarian regimes, plagued by bribery and corruption, are always going to field deficient militaries. What do you think about that?
What I think is they're doing what I've seen for the last 25 years. They're trying to convince themselves that they can accept unacceptable levels of risk because there's some rabbit they can pull out of a hat that lowers the risk. In this case, operational capability. There are serious questions, which they have in Beijing, about the operational capabilities of the PLA. And that's a good thing. You can't count on that in terms of deterrence. Nor can you expect this integrated deterrence is basically no deterrence. What they're saying is we will deter by punishment with diplomatic and economic tools. Well, has that worked in Ukraine?
No. Yep.
Deter by denial, which is a hard power function.
And that's what Mike Gallagher has been saying all week, and I'm glad you said it again. Jim Talent on Twitter with the Bipartisan Policy Center. Thank you. Bipartisan Policy Center. Thank you, Senator. Follow him at Jim Talent, easiest Twitter handle in America. I'm coming back for Hour 3, America. We got to go back to this dinosaur killed by Larry O'Connor when we return. Welcome back, America. Whenever there is a change in the United States Supreme Court, if you've been teaching con law as long as I have, you look for where there might be changes in the jurisprudence of the court. With the retirement of Justice Breyer and the likely confirmation of Judge Brown Jackson to be Justice Brown Jackson, thought I'd talk to Carrie Severino about this. She runs the Judicial Crisis Network. She's one of the go-to people when it comes to judges and confirmation. Carrie, my over-under originally was 65. I dropped it to 53 after the hearings. That's where it's going to come in. She's going to get 53 votes. What's she going to mean to the court, in your view?
Well, you know, so she's replacing Justice Breyer, who is, yes, one of the liberal justices, and remember the liberal justices all tend to vote as a block much more reliably than the conservative justices already. But of that pretty tight block, he was one of the more moderate. She will not be. The most liberal and progressive nominee that this president was looking for. He had a list of a short list. She was by all accounts the most liberal. So she's going to be someone who on that marginal case, you know, maybe Justice Breyer would have come to some pragmatic compromise with the conservatives. She will not. And I think that's going to be interesting because, you know, you might have thought it would have been smarter for the liberals to appoint someone like that in the hopes of bringing over and being able to appeal to some of the swing votes in the court. I don't think she'll be that kind of justice. I think she'll be more along the lines of where Justice Sotomayor is right now. So kind of articulating the most liberal outcome on any particular issue. But from my perspective, at least, hopefully not the kind of person who's going to appeal to that swing vote on the court, which is what you would need to do as a liberal to really affect the ultimate outcome of the case.
I always go back to when Citizens United came down. People were stunned that Anthony Kennedy was in the majority. I said, I'm not. I've been reading his dissents for years on free speech. There are some conservative members of the court who are also quite defendant oriented, Kerry. And you and I both know that because they are concerned about the individual rights of the defendants, which are listed in the Constitution and the amendments. I think she's going to get some interesting coalitions. I think she's going to write primarily on criminal law. Do you agree?
You know, what she ends up writing on depends a little bit on what she gets assigned by the senior members of the court. On the right, that's going to be either the Chief Justice or Justice Thomas, depending on who's in the majority. On the left, that's going to be either the Chief Justice or Justice Sotomayor, rather, who's now the senior, going to be the senior liberal member of the court. So if they may well decide, because she has this background, to assign her to that. I think, though, that, you know, she isn't someone, by her own acknowledgement, that has a constitutional philosophy. So it's not like she's been doing, you know, deep constitutional law on these issues. I think she's someone who definitely has that perspective, but it's not coming out of where, you know, some Justice Scalia or Justice Thomas. They often have very pro-defendant rulings, but it's because of their approach to certain constitutional provisions, the confrontation clause, the right to a jury trial.
Yes.
All of these things have been kind of reinvigorated, but because they have this constitutional philosophy. She's not bringing that philosophy to it, but she may well bring that perspective, that pro-defendant perspective to it. And so she may ultimately get assigned some of those cases. But I don't think it's going to have – wouldn't have the same jurisprudential impact because it's not coming from a philosophical approach that's then going to bleed into other areas.
She's going to bring that vote. And mm-hmm. so that vote will bring some – there is a tradition on the court to try and assign – majority opinions equally among the justices throughout the term. And so if you've got a defendant's right opinion that has brought over a couple of the conservatives who are originalists when it comes to the rights of the defendant, she's going to get those opinions, I think. Now, generally speaking, do you think her hearings will change her point of view at all? Will she be, for example, more sensitive on sentencing cases involving child porn?
Well, you know, thankfully, that case is not likely to come up to the court just because of the types of issues they tend to consider. So hopefully her anomalous views, and it's not just about child porn, this is actually her views.
We lost you there, Carrie.
Approach toward sentencing that just tends to be a thumb on the scale there. But thankfully the Supreme Court isn't addressing those as much, but you could see that approach of I'm going to do everything I can to kind of find excuses to get someone off, potentially bleeding into other areas of the law when she's sitting on the bench.
You know, I think we're going to see a lot of 7-2 cases, Carrie, because I don't think Justice Kagan wants to be left out of the game. And she wants to work with the Chief Justice and maybe Justice Kavanaugh to we got 3-2, 1-2. That's how I view the court right now. Let me flash forward and get your prediction on our abortion jurisprudence. I believe Roe is done for. I think Casey is done for. Do you agree with me?
I think based on the arguments in December, I think that is absolutely correct. Of course, we know from 1991, when the last big case challenging Roe came up, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, that there actually was a switch, you know, because the internal documents had revealed that they were going to go one way and then they switched to go another way. So I am just hoping and praying that that the court doesn't there aren't some backroom shenanigans that say, you know, actually we're gonna come up short of actually doing what the Constitution says here because of outside pressure. Because I think that this intimidation campaigns, the pressure campaigns, the court, if that continues to leak in, that's really dangerous. But I think based on what we've seen so far from the arguments, I agree.
And Carrie, I think they look out at the United States. This week, Oklahoma signed a complete ban on abortion, not even with an exception for rape or incest, which is actually makes sense if you're a pro-lifer and a constitutionalist, but with a life of the mother exception in the Oklahoma statute. So the justices look out. No matter what they decide, they're not going to stop the abortion debate. Colorado just adopted one of the most radical abortion rights laws ever. And so they must say they failed. There is no consensus. There is no way for them to do this. Isn't it just best to throw in and say, okay, for 50 years we tried, we're done?
Well, yeah, but the best reason is the Constitution doesn't say anything about it.
Right.
So
right.
I'm sorry, even if you thought we could do something, it's not your job. But I think this has proven that when you step out of your lane, when you try to invent things and you say, oh, we're going to be the ones who just bring peace and harmony and wonderful things to the country, that's not your job. And you trying to do that job is never going to be successful. And so this is, I think they just need to acknowledge that was a failed effort. It was never going to be successful. And we need to let the states hammer this out where the Constitution doesn't speak to the issue.
And Carrie, I think that's what's going to happen. I really do think the Chief Justice is going to write. And I think Justice Breyer is going to, you know, leave with his final dissent on the final day of his career on the court, authoring the dissenting opinion, which the others will join as a salute to Justice Breyer. And then we will move on in the country. Now, the shadow docket. I think this is nonsense. The shadow docket, there is no such thing as a shadow docket. There are dockets in which the court either hears argument or doesn't. There is no obligation for them to hear argument. They disposed of a case 5-4 yesterday. It's a regulatory case. I'm interested in it because it's a regulatory case, but no one else is. And the chief joined with the three because he wanted argument. Would you please speak to this? This is one of those talking points of the left that is gaining traction in the blue bubble, and it's making me crazy.
Yeah. So the idea of the shadow docket is there's certain cases that come up as emergency appeals to the court that they haven't gone through the regular process because they're emergency. For example, they come up a lot in the death penalty case because you don't have time to have a whole oral argument before someone is executed generally. So in these regulatory cases, because they're getting ready to do something that would have effects that would just have a long lasting effect. You have to say stop, and then we'll decide, and then we can go back. And that's, that is a perfectly normal part of the process, not just at the Supreme Court, but at every single level, that you have to have emergency stays. There have been people on the left who have been trying to suggest that this is somehow illegitimate, and you know they're not sincere because they're so inconsistent. It's only illegitimate in their mind when it happens to have a conservative result. So if someone, for example, Justices Breyer and Ginsburg, for years decided we should stay every single execution on the shadow docket, right? But no, it's not. There's nothing shadowy about
the shadow docket. Can I tell you what our shadow docket was at the D.C. Circuit when I clerked at D.C. Circuit? We had a lot of Amish parents who wanted their children to get transfusions and Seventh-day Adventists, but they wanted a court to order it. And they never wanted to have an argument on it. So we had, our shadow docket was full of people who wanted medical care for their children that they would not themselves seek, but which they knew the courts would give. That was the, quote, shadow docket. We didn't, it was like weekly, Kerry. It's not a big deal, but boy, our media falls for this every single time.
Oh, yeah. And they, again, no one's digging and going, hey, this is weird. The liberals voted to grant some motions. They do it all the time. Of course they do. But they only complain. It's just like they do the same thing with overturning cases. It, you know, if Roe is overturned this June, it's going to be, oh, my gosh, precedent. Can you believe they overturned a case? This is an outrage. This is against the American ideal. And then, you know, they'll be like, oh, yeah, Heller should be overturned because that was the wrong decision on the Second Amendment. You know, they only want to overturn the cases they think are wrong. And that's fine. But don't pretend like it's an illegitimate thing. So they like to use this name calling type of argument when they lose on the actual argument.
And yesterday it was presented that the Chief Justice is against the use of the shadow docket. No, he was against an emergency order without a hearing in that case, but he lost. And it's a 5-4 court, mm-hmm. so he lost. Kerry, let me turn to where the court is going, big picture, because you actually, one of the few people who study this like Molly and like me, I am very, very hopeful that the First Amendment is going to be buttressed. I think religious liberty is going to be buttressed by First Amendment, I mean speech. I think regulatory Rapanos has gone the way. Are you an optimist of the next 3 years? I am. I'm very optimistic. I just want them to go faster.
Oh, yeah. No, I agree. And I agree on the faster part, too. I think some of the newer justices are like, great, here we are. And we can, you know, take step by step things. And I'm going, no. It's taken a decade to get this majority move now.
Move.
The left would not
move.
The left
yes.
would not be walking slowly. But I think this is the strongest court we have had, certainly in my lifetime, probably in living memory.
And it's in my lifetime, and I'm a lot older than you. Yep.
Yeah, exactly.
It's coherent.
On all those issues and more.
Yeah, and I am hopeful on the abortion case especially, and I want to get your legal opinion on this. It would be better for the country if they ruled sooner rather than the last day of June or the first week of July, because there are people whose lives depend upon knowing the answer to this case. Do you agree with me?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, there's a lot of states that have already worked out how they're going to address this issue. There's no objective reason they have to wait, but I don't think I'm super confident they're going to move faster. Because remember, even if all the justices in the majority thought, hey, we need to, this would be good for the country to have this decision come out sooner, they have to wait on the judges writing a dissent. And if they'd rather drag it out, it gets dragged out because it doesn't come out till everyone's ready. And unfortunately, that normally happens at the end of June.
You know, Kerry, I had a justice joke to me once. The reason they do that is they get out of town then, and they don't have to worry about the blowback at the court. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's legitimate? Is that a joke or is that real?
I don't think it's entirely a joke. I mean, they a lot of them literally, some of these people are going, maybe they'll extend the term.
No, I
know of justices who have flight tomorrow. So they're not.
They are out. They are gone.
They're not just out of town, out of the country often.
Yeah. They are usually going off to teach at a law school somewhere for the summer. Kerry Severino, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, Kerry, because you actually know what you're talking about.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
with in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.